Life is 10% what happens to us and 90% how we respond to it. The right mindset is what separates most successful people from the average person. Changing your mindset can be one of the most valuable skills you can learn to help you create your own kick-ass life. Well, we want to help you begin that process today and give you a free copy of David Wood's training, Mindset, Your Key to Success. In this downloadable training, you'll learn how to develop a winner's mindset, how to overcome limiting and negative beliefs, how to love the word no, and much, much more. To download your free training, simply go to thekickasslife.com/free. That's thekickasslife.com/F-as-in-Frank-R-E-E.
Hey, this is Les Hewitt, author of The Power of Focus, and you're listening to David Wood on the Kick-Ass Life Show.
Make your life better? This is the Kick-Ass Life Podcast with David Wood.
Hey, good morning and welcome to the Kick-Ass Life Show. Today's Tuesday, which means we have a guest. Although, I'm not with that guest right now. I had to pre-record today's show because we are actually, as of midnight last night, in Phoenix, Arizona, and we're in a car right now. Hi, Jen.
Hello.
And we are driving up to the office. I have meetings all day, and then tomorrow I start a program called Powerful Presentations. One of my big passions in life is training trainers, teachers, anyone who's in front of a room. The beauty is you don't even have to have aspirations to be a trainer to work in these events that I create, primarily because it just changes you one-on-one. It changes you in your relationships when you really work on these skills and understand the fundamentals. I don't just teach you how to be clever up there, because one of the big lessons I had to learn, which I think has carried through into my life, is to be interested, not interesting. And I hear that a lot with podcasts. You know, when I don't listen to many, but the ones I listen to, sometimes if the host is somebody who likes to be interesting, their guests sort of, every time the guests talk, they're sort of talking over them. Where I think, you know, in life, if we go with that philosophy, and especially on stage, when we step up there and we're interested in the audience, we're interested in where they're at, we're interested in the conversation. And that's what I always teach my trainers, is the moment. And teachers, if you're teaching school kids, you know, if you can learn some fundamentals around accelerated whole brain learning, which is what I teach, about the conversation between a student and a teacher. And it's really interesting, because it doesn't have to be a verbal conversation, but it has to be an energetic conversation. It's constantly checking in with the audience, constantly allowing your students to be a part of it, to interact with you, and to really, what it does is it allows the learning to go so deep. So again, big key to be interested, not interesting. Anyway, my guest today is a guy that I've had on stage, one of my programs, one of my advanced programs called Beyond Courage. And it's I run this program in Santa Barbara, California, in a beautiful resort called El Capitan Canyon Resort. And just an amazing, amazing place. And I watched this guy. I knew him. I mean, you know, we've become friends over the years here. But I knew him not very well when he first came on my stage. And I watched him take somebody who was completely phobic, terrified, absolutely full of fear around a snake, and within 35, 40 minutes, having a massive python wrapped around them, stroking it, loving it. So what does that tell you about the brain? That fascinates me, that we can recondition ourselves so incredibly quickly, and really, truly change the way that we approach ourselves, the world, the story in our head. Because in the end of the day, remember, whether you believe it to be true or whether you believe it to be false, you're right. You're always going to be right. It doesn't matter. You see the world as you are internally. So when I can watch somebody using a technique like this, and of course it's something that he is truly...
Sorry, the one south.
We're going the 101 south. Okay. See, we're getting directions as we speak. It doesn't get real of this, ladies and gentlemen.
Sorry to interrupt.
All right. You're just going to interrupt right away there, Jen. Look, you let her on the show and suddenly she won't shut up.
I want to get to the office.
And... We're joking. Yeah. So, you know, it just is that fascinating thing to say, well, what's possible for each of us? What's possible for anything, any story in our head? And I know he wrote a book, you know, Don't Let People Rent Space in Your Head. And that's a really great analogy, is how often we do that. You know, we let other people, we let the world, we let conditioning rent space in our head. And it stops us from everything that we want to achieve in life. It really gets in the way. So anyway, with that said, I want you to sit back, relax, as we're driving here through Phoenix, this very, very busy road on an early morning, trying to find our way to the office. And you sit back and relax and enjoy my conversation with the wonderful Gary Cox. Y'all, you know, here I am again, starting a show. And, you know, I always say it, you think I'm going to come up with something really imaginative. I never do. Here I go. I'm excited. And I really am excited, you know, because there are people I've worked with on stage that really are great. You know, they do great things. There's a lot of motivation. You know, people really, really feel great about themselves. And there's other people you work with on stage where you actually witness something that's so transformational, it's hard to describe. And if you were to tell people afterwards, they would find it hard to believe. Well, my guest is that person. So, Gary, welcome to the show.
David, good to be here. Thank you so much for the invite. I'm looking forward to this.
Yeah, well, me too. You know, Gary, you and I chat quite a bit, and it's great to know that our orbits don't always collide, but we're always in touch with each other. Gary, if I go back to that moment I'm talking about, just to give people context about the power of your work, and I won't give too much away, but we'll dive into it a little bit. You know, okay. So we've got somebody sitting in the audience who's obviously phobic. Now, phobic, how would you describe phobic? I mean, to give it context, what is that phobic?
Basically something that's irrational, something that a way a person reacts that's not the norm. You know, like some people, you know, if you have to constantly clean behind yourself, you know, you're always cleaning something and the average person doesn't do it as much, you probably have some type of a compulsive disorder. If you see a dog, the average person sees a dog, it's no big deal, but maybe one particular person sees a dog and freaks out, starts panicking, can't get close to it. That's not your normal behavior, so that would be referring to as something that's irrational.
Sure, and then with that irrationality comes an immense amount of fear for some people. When we're talking about spiders or snakes or dogs or animals, I mean, you see, or anything like that, where heights, I mean, where people go into absolute terror. I mean, and that's what we're talking about with the situation we're about to describe, right?
Yeah, what it amounts to is we're giving power to something or someone else, David. And the thing is, if we're not careful, if we don't develop the right mindset and the right thought process, we're going to be controlled by so many things. So the thing that I work with people on phobias, it's just a very powerful example to show people how quick our thought process can change when we know how to do it. And unfortunately, a lot of times we work so hard to do that, but there are specific formulas and thought processes and ideas and steps that we can do to work this a lot quicker when it comes to changing any type of behavior or thinking. And that's my thing. You know, I love to show people how to make quick change with lasting results.
Yeah, and that's what, I mean, when we talk about quick now, we're talking about this is extraordinarily quick. So someone's phobic, they come up and work with you in front of a live audience, no less. So let's add the complexity of a live audience. Let's add the complexity of a random pick. Hands go up in the audience. Now, you didn't know anyone in that audience because that was my audience.
That was your audience, yeah.
And we were in a remote camp in California, and I really didn't know you back then. This is a number of years ago. So, and actually the person that stands up is someone I know. And here you go. You have them on stage, and it's obvious these guys are terrified. And not only are they terrified, the other people in the audience that have similar fears, you're able to allow the whole audience to jump into their own fear processes, or phobic processes, and actually lead them through it in what, an hour and 30 minutes, was it?
Well, the whole presentation is about an hour and 30 minutes, you know, giving me time to explain to people how our thinking works and so forth. But the actual part, we can knock it out in in 15 to 20 minutes. My little thing is I do in an hour what a therapist can't do in a year. Nothing against therapists or anything, but there's quicker ways to get things done in life.
Yeah, and so when we look at that as a let's blow this one out into a big sort of message, right? So the idea is if somebody can do that, if they can jump through and fit, you're typing, by the way, we can hear you.
Oh, sorry.
That's all right. But if people are able to jump through in 15 minutes or 30 minutes or a half an hour, something that they haven't been able to jump through their entire life, then what else is possible, Gary?
Yeah, that's the key. You know, when we look at wanting to be more successful in our lives, when it comes to, you know, whether it be relationships or diet or finances or business, we have so many stories, as you know. We all tell different stories. And, you know, my thing is as you may know my story, which if I wasn't careful, I could have let it really, really control me. And that's where my wife and I, you know, we got married. And before that, I was very successful. I was, as a teenager, making $100,000 a year in business. And no, I wasn't doing drugs. I was very fortunate to be my family's first generation jeweler. And then I got married. A wife and I, we have a baby. She tells me it's not mine. My father was murdered. Grandfather and stepfather died of cancer. I had like $100,000 a year business. I lost all of this. And all of this and so much more happened to me by the time I was 21 years of age. So what it was is I decided I needed to get out of this and change this, but I noticed there was a dramatic change in my personality, my attitude, everything compared to before that time and after that time. And the only different thing is that happened was an experience or a group of experiences and how I looked at those. And it really came very close to destroying me, which could be understandable. So I had to figure out, okay, how do I get through this quickly? So I became my own doctor and my own patient. You know, I started to identify the behaviors and the things I did to relive that story, such as, you know, poor me. I wanted people to be sympathetic to me. My pity party probably lasted longer than it should. And I started doing things to make things worse, you know, closing the curtains, living in a dark room, listening to music that's depressing. And I started picking up on all these behaviors until I got to the point I said, enough's enough now. I've got to make some changes. I was successful before, also in business, and I needed to get back to that. So yeah, I had a lot of limitations when it came to that. You know, the fear of failure, fear of success, you name it, it was there.
So, I mean, I love this analogy, doctor-patient idea, right? But
yeah.
I mean, if everyone today just sort of says, well, I want to become my own doctor, my own patient, I mean, they don't need to really. I mean, because there's shortcuts. But where did you start? Were you reading the right books? Were you hanging around some certain people? I mean, or were you just looking at yourself and you figured this out just totally alone? What happened?
Yeah, no, I've never, unfortunately, hate to admit it, been a book reader. I didn't start reading books literally until probably the last 4 years ago. I was never a big book reader. But I could see it in my behavior. It wasn't successful. I had to, you know, again, I had such a contrast, David, from, you know, being this younger, quote unquote, whiz kid that had everything and had this great attitude and was a go-getter. And then all of a sudden there's this contrast now that, you know, every little thing triggers me to cry. You know, I can't keep a relationship. And it was like, okay, wait a minute here. And they were so close together, because all these tragedies happened to me in such a short period of time, I was able to see a huge difference between here is where I used to be and the attitude I used to have to where I'm at now. And it was common sense to let me know and tell me, because what actually happened was these experiences. But well, there's a lot of people who go through experiences that come out of it, you know, pretty darn well. Well, I was one of those people who did not. And I knew that the only difference was how I looked at things. So I had to just look at things totally different. Like, you know, if you're not careful, you can have your wife tell you your baby's not yours and you can be a woman hater after that. You could lose your business and never go ahead and take the risk and try it again. So I had to look at myself and I had to take responsibility, such as I'm the one that chose the wrong woman. And, you know, if I can buy that, which I have bought that from pretty much day one, then I don't go out there bashing women. I lost everything financially. I don't blame it on everything else or everyone else. And that's the tendency that we have a tendency of doing. And I think that really prevents us from growing and being better. We always want, I mean, it's just a human tendency. There's three things that we do as humans that really prevent ourselves from being successful or more successful. And we all do this. And we all do it subconsciously. Number one is you try to justify your behavior. Number two, we always try to minimize the fault. And number three, we always try to blame it on somebody else. Those are three things that we all subconsciously do. We're born this way. And if you're not consciously aware of it, you'll blame everything and everyone on every part of our failures. Of course, our successes, we want to take credit for that, you know?
So this idea then, there's three steps. As you start, I really want to go back in that time because, you know, obviously you had these horrendous things happen. I mean, really horrendous, all at once. I mean, they were compounded so fast and they were in all parts of your psyche. I mean, we're talking about our intimacy. We're talking about our relationships. We're talking about our finances. I mean, we're talking about the big three right here. And you've had it all dumped on you as a young punk, not punk, but a young whiz kid, right? And you come out with such clarity and certainty and then you write this book, Don't Let Others Rent Space in Your Head. So this ability to change the story, and we see it. I mean, you can tell with people who are living in a dark story or people who are living in a minimal story or people who are living in a story that doesn't serve them. And you can actually notice it by walking up to them. But why is it we get trapped in these stories that don't serve us? I mean, have you figured out why people do it or why?
Well, it's programming. I'll give you a perfect example, which is, I think, is really powerful. You know, if we're not careful, we're so, you know, subject to be programmed for so many things. And one of the things is, I think a lot of times we have a real problem with, David, all of us, as just being human, is we have a challenge distinguishing the difference between being a leader of our feelings or a slave to our feelings. For example, if we feel sad, we normally what? Act sad, right? If we feel happy, we usually act happy. Now, what I'm about to say is what we should be doing, but we all agree it's a lot easier said than done. When we feel sad, we should try to do what? We should try to act happy. Well, why is that so difficult? Well, one of the reasons that's so difficult is because, and here's the key. The answer is what we should be doing is when what I'm about. Let me give you this. What I'm going to share with you is what we should be doing, but I think most people will agree it is very, very challenging. What we should be doing is when we feel sad, we should try to do what? We should try to act happy. Now, why is that so difficult? The answer is probably the most powerful answer in giving people the greatest clue in mastering their behavior. And the answer is anytime, David, that we try to do anything opposite of how we feel, we will feel as if we're lying. For example, all of us, we've been rightfully programmed as a young child not to lie. So anytime we get to a crossroad in our mind with any type of a negative feeling or emotion, fear of failure, fear of success, rejection, frustration, whatever it is, we always like to take the course of least resistance. So what's the course of least resistance when we experience a negative feeling or emotion? It's usually to reward that, knowing if we reward it, we don't get results. So why do we not push through it if in fact we don't? Well, I think I've discovered a very powerful reason why. And the reason for that, David, is when we were born, one of the first things that we did was we started to cry. So when we were hungry, we cried. When we wanted to go to the bathroom, we cried. And how often did we do this? We did this, what, hour after hour, month after month, year after year. So for years, we're a total slave to our feelings. Now, here's where it gets really scary, David. We've been told that the most impressionable part of our lives as a human is the first 5 years. If that is true, do you realize that we spend nearly half or more than half of the most impressionable part of our lives being a slave to our feelings? So what happens now is we live in this unconscious state if we're not careful. And the moment we relive a story from our past, you know, my wife cheating on me or my baby's not really mine, how we start immediately associating or what we associate to that story instantly will create a feeling. Now, if the feeling is a negative feeling and we're not consciously aware of it, what are we going to do? We're going to reward that feeling. And how do we reward that negative feeling? Now we get depressed and, you know, we don't go out or we start feeling sorry for ourselves. And a lot of people, they're just not consciously aware of that. And you stop and think about every moment that you're awake for a day. And this is, you know, as you're listening to this, every moment you're awake for the day, what percentage of that day would you write down as I am a slave to my feelings or I am a leader of my feelings? Now, here's a great clue to help people master the ability to be a leader of their feelings. When my feelings, these would be negative feelings, when my feelings are not in harmony with my goals, ignore my feelings. Now, I'm not going here. Obviously, we're not going to be here for hours and go into deep, you know, head game stuff here. I'm talking about not major stuff that you may need some really deep therapy. I'm just, you know, be realistic and use common sense. So when my feelings, when my negative feelings are not in harmony with my goals, ignore my feelings. What do we usually do? We usually reward them. So we've got to learn to ignore negative feelings and not reward them. And that is not the easiest thing to do. And if you're not in a level of really being aware of your emotions and feelings, your feelings will usually beat you before you beat them.
I want to play devil's advocate for a second and ask you a couple of questions around this. So something happens, you know, your wife leaves you, you know, you lose a child. I mean, anything, any of these things, you know, you lose a loved one, somebody embezzles millions of dollars. Now, and I understand exactly what you're saying, because I teach around this subject as well, you know, but the question is, what about initially? You know, so initially someone leaves. Do you subscribe to the fact that feeling it before you ignore it, or do you feel that you can just change the story? And is there a fear that you can become somebody that's sort of more stuffing feelings, or is there any part of this where you can just feel like where you can beat a pillow and get really mad and then boom, change the story? Or should you change the story?
That's a really good question, and that's where we have to find the balance. So depending on the person's mindset, I have a mindset that is, how fast can I bounce back? All right. So when something dramatic happens in my life, how fast can I bounce back? Which means bouncing back, depending on the situation, will also mean to grieve. So yes, I believe depending on the situation, losing a loved one, there's a grieving process. If I have a loved one that I'm lost, trust me, I'm going to grieve. But I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I'm probably going to make it a point to grieve faster, harder, and quicker than the average person. For example, I found out where my wife was cheating on me. Now, in most cases, what do you think I would do, or most people would do? They would give power to that location. And so instead of driving past it, they would drive around it. So I've learned early in my life that time does not heal all wounds. I do. I don't want to wait on time to heal all wounds. I don't want to wait that long. So what did I do? I drove past it. Did I cry? Absolutely. I didn't force myself not to cry. I made myself cry. I drove back and cried and forth and cried and back and cried and forth and cried until I got it out of my system. But now there's points with some people that they stick and they get stuck into that emotional area where all they're doing is crying and crying and crying 20 years later. And then there's a problem. That's where the problem is. So yeah, one of the things that I do, and if I don't do a lot of one-on-one work, but whenever I do, if it's something serious, like, you know, a loss of a loved one, divorce, something major, I want to find out, have you grieved yet? And if you have, great, because that's important. And then how long is the grieving process? Is it way longer than the average person? Then if it is, now we got to go in and start changing things up using some of these thought processes when my feelings are not in harmony with my goals, you know, et cetera, working on changing that story, looking for different visions, et cetera. So in answer to your question, yeah, it's very important. It depends on the situation, how deep, how long, but that grieving process is extremely important. I'll tell you an example. Somebody did something to me. You were just talking about somebody embezzling something, you know, in your company. It just happened to me a couple months ago. In fact, we're putting together a case now where, you know, the guy's most likely to be arrested. So it was huge. I mean, this guy, I mean, it was a great loss for the company. It was huge financially, huge. When I found out what happened, I said to myself, how fast can I emotionally rebound? And what would I do to reward it negatively or not? Well, drinking for me is a rare thing to do. So I drank 2 glasses of wine and I had some fried calamari, which I never eat fried foods because, you know, my diet's really strict. And that was the very next day I bounced back up. And if I told you what the whole story was, you would see that most people would probably just throw in the towel and quit their business right away. So but I'm consciously aware of this. How fast can I bounce back? And then I clean it out emotionally. And then I don't keep living in that past. I mean, can I talk about it? You know, yeah, I can talk about it. Are there ripple effects that we're going to be affected with right now? Absolutely. But I don't relive the emotion and go, oh my goodness, I can't believe this happened to me. Life happens.
You know,
it takes a while to get to that point. This doesn't happen overnight.
What I love about this is that everything I believe in, I believe along the lines, I don't use the same language in all of the way you describe this, but if we went back to the grieving process, and there may be someone listening right now, I mean, we're in 158 countries. series, there's a good chance somebody's listening right now is in the process of grieving a lost one, a loved one, you know, because it just statistically, you know, there's a lot of people dying every single day.
Yeah.
But there is a way to live life where you can experience death in a really positive and beautiful way. Understanding is the only thing that really is certain. Understanding you can grieve in a different way too. There's a different picture of grieving. You can grieve in a way where you're actually reliving and celebrating someone's life. You can grieve in a way where you can be really open to talk about them and share stories about them. And you can go through the crying process and the sad process. But I really do believe, Gary, and 100% in what you're saying, is that this idea of, you know, how fast can I bounce back? If you start practicing with small things and you start building that muscle, yes, when it comes to the major things, when Absolutely. It comes to big stuff, you can actually bounce back pretty fast without being a hard, you know, your heart is surrounded in cement, and without being a hard ass, without being all these things, you can actually be very gentle and still completely present. So the reason I'm enforcing what you said is because I'm sure for some people who are in the middle of something right now, they can find these words very hard to hear, right?
Well, yeah, the thing is, you know, for example, let's say we have somebody listening that is having a hard time listening to that and buying into some of this. Well, number one, it's true. It's just you're at a point right now that you're still maybe going through the grieving process. I have a program, 7 Ways to Manage Extreme Crisis in Your Life, and I go through the steps and what it takes to make change. And for example, when we go through something negative, whether it's in our business or personally, relationship, lose girlfriend, boyfriend, one of the things that happens if we're not careful is we lose hope. And as scripture says, hope is the anchor to the soul. So one of the things that I've had to learn in my life is I've had to learn to have a lot of hope. And sometimes you can lose all hope. And when you lose all hope, that's what happens when somebody's suicidal. I was at a program I was doing about 2.5 weeks ago, and I noticed this lady came up to the area near where I was at. I was getting close to her, and she was just in tears. And she expressed to me, it was at that particular day is when she wanted to commit suicide. Well, the first thing that goes off in my mind, why does somebody want to go that far? They've lost all their hope. You don't think that way if you have hope. So the first thing that we've got to do is bring you back some hope. So we've got to go through our inventory of hope. And hope for you may be different than hope for me. And sometimes when you get some people, you know, you can say, well, you know, you've got your kids, you've got your family. They know all that. And if that's not enough that they already know, that's not giving them enough hope, we got to go in a little deeper. So that's one of the first things I tell people, whether it be in sales, you know, in a relationship, you have got to do your very best to keep your hope alive in so many different areas in life. And if you only have one or two hopes in your life and you lose one or two of them, you've lost 50% of your hope, or you've lost all your hope. And this is why, because people are so prone, we all are, to being a slave to our feelings. And that's why, you know, when the economy goes crazy, people buy more alcohol and the drug abuse goes up and divorce rate goes up. It's because we lack the ability to take the time to master our emotions. I wouldn't say lack the ability. We have the ability, but not make it a priority. And like you said, the best time to do this is in the little stuff. When the stuff hits the fan, man, I feel sorry for people when they haven't been buying into this type of thinking and this type of attitude. And the worst time to figure this out is not when it's all hit the fan. Trust me.
Exactly, you know, and this idea of, you know, an event's going to happen. Two guys, let's pretend, you know, you and Jim are standing next to each other, same event.
Yeah.
Different story. You have no story about it, or you've built that muscle. You have no problem. Jim hasn't even started thinking this way, where he can master his feelings.
Yeah.
And so he creates this massive story. He has a massive problem, and his life starts changing direction, right?
You know, I'll give you a perfect example. That's so true what you say there, David, is because I did a program in, I think this was in Canada, and a lady, you know, she was speaking at the program with me. I brought her out of the audience, and her thing was she had another brother. Her brother was like a year older than she was, and she remembered something when she was 3 and he was like 4 years old. And every time their grandfather, same event, every time their grandfather would come visit them, he'd give each one of them a dollar. Same event, same price, I mean, same little gift. So as she got older, she began to understand the value of money. Then she perceived in her mind that, wait a minute, every time grandpa sees me, I'm only worth a dollar? Whereas her brother, every time he got the dollar, he just jumped for joy and got all excited. So now here she is in her 40s, and because of how she has perceived that, she feels worthless, which tells us, you know, you can never be a perfect parent. If you, there's no way even trying to try to be a perfect parent, because you could be, by the book, the most perfect person or parent in the world, but your child is the person who makes the choice of the perception they buy into, and that's a perfect example.
Yeah, that truly is. I always say the easy way out for all parents listening, as a parent of two, we all screw up our kids. Get over it. So, Gary, I want to look around in your life a little bit more. So, and I want to, I mean, we haven't really finished the story about where we started. So you bring up this person on stage. They're terrified. They're phobic. And within an hour, they're wrapping this snake, a big snake, around their body. Their phobia is snake, right? And they're totally in relationship. They've totally reprogrammed in just 15, 20, 30 minutes. And remember, you're teaching a whole class.
Yeah.
And they've reprogrammed their association with this thing that they've been terrified of their entire life. Yeah. All right. And so the same strategy that you use in, and I know there's lots of them, but the same strategy that we can use in those circumstances, we can use in all circumstances, right?
Yeah, no question about it. And as you saw me doing that when you brought me in to work with your team there, is one of the things that we have to identify is our belief system. We all know that. So one of the things that I share is, for every belief that you act on, you get a result. So what I do is, when I'm working with somebody, is I help them identify some of the beliefs, because whatever result that we get either from that limited or that empowering belief. So obviously, if a person is phobic of a snake, and of course, so I just use this as an example because it's very powerful to watch somebody literally change in front of you. The idea is let me find out what's in your head. What are the thought processes? What are the beliefs that you're acting on that gets you this result, that gets you the result of making your heart beat faster, making you sweat at the palms? We don't consciously say, oh my, I'm scared of this, whatever, let me sweat at the palms. So I actually have them write it down. So now we can take out what's in their head and put it on paper. Now we've got an attack plan. See, a lot of times people are so, you know, I mean, we all are, we get so caught up into our own thinking that it just starts to go, and we just don't stop it. So if we can figure out, okay, what's going on in my head, and I have them write down now, and here's the thing. The beliefs could be the most dumbest, ridiculous, irrational thing, but if you believe it, it's real. So if the person says, the snake's going to swallow me, well, they know logically that it's not going to swallow them. Emotionally, when they become irrational, they still know it logically, but they can't reason. So they're so fearful, petrified, or whatever. And it could be, you know, if you're driving over a bridge and that's your fear, the fear could be the bridge is going to collapse. Well, we know within reason, you know, we don't hear collapsing of bridges on a regular basis. So it becomes irrational. So as crazy, as stupid as it sounds, I have them write it down. Then I show them how to counteract it. Now, one of the things I talk about, and a lot of people are big into this affirmation stuff and positive thinking. So my key on my take on this, David, is positive thinking is like spray paint on rust. It does not last long. You know, you can get an African gray bird that's like the best bird talker in the world, and you could teach that bird to say, I'm the next $1 million whatever person, and I look like Beyonce and Cindy Crawford, and that bird can say it all day long, and nothing is going to change. So that brings us to affirmations now. So here's my take on affirmations. The more you say a positive affirmation, the less you believe it. That's why you keep saying it. I think it's very powerful to repeat. The more you keep saying a positive affirmation, the less you believe it. That's why you keep saying it. And to prove that point, when I woke up this morning, I did not have to look at myself in the mirror and say, you're a man, you're a man, you're a man. I get that. So what I do, though, is I do start people off with affirmations. So the affirmation is, for example, if you wrote down your limited belief like the snake is going to swallow me, the opposite of that is the snake is not going to swallow me. Well, that right now is an affirmation because they really don't believe it. So what's my goal? My goal is to get them to convert the affirmation to a belief. Why would that be? Because for every belief we act on, we get a what? We get a result. So if I want to get her to get a different result, we first have to identify the limited belief and then convert it to an affirmation, and then we convert it to a new belief. And that's when change starts to happen.
There's something you do, though. I mean, when I watch your posture, within this, because, you know, there's this idea of a tough love. There's this idea of, you know, people buying into people's stories, you know, so someone else has got a story, you know, yeah. So someone else is phobic. You watch, like, normally thousands of people jump in with them and they start to coddle that kind of limiting process in their mind, yeah. And it becomes worse, right? But there's something about the way that you sit, the way you ask questions. I mean, there's definitely love there, but there's also this certainty that there is something else going to be happening in 15, 20 minutes. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, when people are going through their darkest times and you know, when they're really, really in there well? I mean, what's that balance between love and tough love and you know, being able to just be a force around people that isn't always cascading into other people's stories? Do you know what I'm? Yeah, do you get the question?
Yeah, and if I get off of it a little bit, you know, bring me back on. I think one of the things is we have to find a balance, and the balance is going to be depending on the person you're working with. So if you know, like, for example, if you and I have a tragedy, we know we think strong. We get the whole idea of, you know, we create our own world, et cetera, et cetera. So if I came to you with a big challenge, I know I can lean on your shoulders. And I'm hoping you'd be sympathetic, as I would be to you. But then sooner or later, you're going to say to me, and I can handle this from you where somebody else may not, I can handle you saying, okay, Gary, we're going through some pretty crappy stuff now. We're going to figure out, when are we getting ready to go ahead and make that move to, quote unquote, move on. So, yeah, it becomes a thin line, and everybody's a little bit different. And that's why when I work with individuals, and corporations have this as a whole too, and so do we as individuals. So what's your core belief? What's your background like? And as I find that out in working with people, it kind of gives me a measuring rod as to how fast I can go. Now, of course, when I'm doing this live demonstration, I have an ultimatum and a goal, and that goal is to get this person reversed as fast as they can. So to get to that point, I find out, are you in? And I get them to find out if they're in before they get on stage. So when somebody says, look, Gary, I'm in to work with you to become more successful in my business, or I'm in to work with you to have a better relationship, then if you give me permission, we're going to move on, and we're going to move on fast. And that has a lot to do with it as well. So if, for example, I'll give you a typical case. I know of a lady who has been on medication all of her life. And I asked her a question. You know, she was a depressant and the whole nine yards. And I said, let me ask you a question. This might, my question to her, David, was to find out if she was in. The question was, if you chose, and her belief was, her mom was there, her sister was there. They too are also on antidepressants. And her story was that it's inherited because my family is depressed and they're on antidepressants. So I am too. So I said to her, here was the question. What if you chose to believe that was not true? And her comment gave me everything I needed to know. She just went off on me. That told me right there, her attitude is not ready. So if she would have said, you know, wow, I never thought about that. What do you mean? Now she's opened the door a little bit. But because her attitude was, what are you talking about? My mom, as she points to her mom, my mom's on the meds. My sister, she points to her sister's over there. She's on it too. I knew at that point there's nothing more I could have done, because I'm pushing a parked car at that time. And then 2 weeks later, I come over to her place, and then I go into their bathroom because I was called to go out there. And she had a portable heater. She tried to put it in the bathtub and electrocute herself. The bathtub was still full of water, but the cord wasn't long enough. Then we walked over to the bedroom, and she had OD'd, and she was dead right there. So that's what I try to find out. First of all, are you in? And if you're not in, there's nothing you can do. I mean, that in part, that buying in, making ready to make that change, no one can make you do that. Somebody can influence you to do that, but that's a click that when you're ready to click it on, it happens. We can only influence people that are not there to try to get there faster.
But the truth is, Gary, I mean, and there could have been, you know, 100 other people in the room, exactly the same story, exactly the same circumstances, exactly the same age, exactly the same background, who were ready, and they could have made a new step, a new strive. Doesn't matter what the story is.
Right.
And you were very careful to say early on, you know, that there are some people who could be listening that really do need to go and seek therapy that really do need to, you know, to go clinically and be looked after. But what we're talking about here is the power of the mind. And the truth is that the mind can do the most remarkable things. And when, if we use the snake as a context again, is somebody who's been phobic their whole life and absolutely terrified to the point of sweating, palpitations, screaming, running, flight, fear, you know, kicking. I mean, completely irrational behavior. To 30 minutes later, having this massive python wrapped around their body and loving it and being in relationship with something they've been terrified of, then no hypnosis, but done in front of a live audience, real time, and through this process, like you said, is where first of all the gates open. They open the door. They say, "I'm ready." You go in there, and they whatever their belief is, however dumb or silly it is, they're writing it down, and you're not discounting it, but then you're giving them a strategy, something that is repetitive that they can start with. Now, if you're at that point right now, can you sort of give us a little look into your next step? I mean, how do you make it permanent? How do they go from
that's the problem. The next step is something that has to be really demonstrated by me explaining it. It's not going to give people a lot of depth at all. But the next step is to now create a new association. So if you have a negative association toward cold calling and selling, if you don't change that association every time you try to do it, you're going to relive that negative feeling and emotion. For example, again, back to the phobia thing as a powerful example. I've had people come to me and say, you know, I've got a fear of snakes or whatever, and they think I need to know how they got that way. I don't need to know. For example, you could have a 2-year-old child that can barely communicate. Let's say you're sitting in front of the TV with your child, you're getting ready to go to the bed, and before you go to bed, the child's watching TV and they see this big, huge snake just, you know, kind of slithering on the grass on the TV. Child goes to bed, 3 o'clock in the morning. You're awoken by the child screaming bloody murder. You run into the bedroom. The child's freaking out. The child is not old enough to explain to you that it just had a nightmare of a snake swallowing it. That child now is phobic for the rest of its life. So as it gets older, if it sees anything like a snake or sees a snake, every time they think of it, they relive it and fill up their emotional hard drive. For example, if you had something, we all have a hard drive. It's like a computer, as you know. You type into a computer, maybe you're typing fast, your computer's not responding. One of the reasons is the hard drive has just got too much stuff in it. So what happens is if you have something happen to you when you were 5 years old that was negative 5 years ago or 5 days ago, loss of a loved one, divorce, financial challenges, whatever, every time you relive that negative emotion, you add more into your emotional hard drive. It's just like if you go online and you download a PDF, maybe you're a little impatient, so you double click it to download it more. You've downloaded it 3 times. Now imagine doing that day after day after day. Sooner or later, your hard drive is going to get filled up. Well, we do that emotionally. So if I can get a person to change that association, sometimes I have to force it. Sometimes it can be just through communication or thought. Sometimes I have to come up with an incredibly creative way to do that. But if that association changes, there is no deep therapy that needs to go in. And everybody's a little different, but it depends on the situation. But that's the key. If the association is totally changed, in other words, I can look at a snake and smile as opposed to looking at a snake and freaking out, that association changes. It's pretty much done, written in stone. That person's probably changed for life. I may give them some exercises in the future to make sure they can keep that going. But the whole key is, it's like, you know, instead of teaching a man how to fish, show them how to, or giving them a fish, I should say, show them how to. So that's what I like to do. My thing is showing people tools that are practical, not into the hocus pocus, you know, blah, 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 you know, but actually going into their thinking that every time I feel this way or think this way, I need a blueprint to get myself back on course. And if you have a blueprint every time, for example, you're in a relationship and there's some friction and conflict, what do you do instantly to solve it? Because you're going to react one way or another. You can react in a negative way and start practicing divorce, or you can react in such a way that you've got a new blueprint that when you react in a different way now, your spouse sees you becoming more loving, more understanding, or whatever. And it's the same thing in business. You know, when we try to make sales, we try to increase our income. It all applies, David, as you well know.
Well, I love about that, and it's a great segue because we don't have too long left in the show, but this idea that, you know, practical real life terms that you could say, you know, whether it was a snake or cold calling, which is really, when you think about it, when you think about people's blueprint for success, you know, you use that as a demonstration quite often to see what's powerful. That gives hope. I mean, people who can watch that transformation happen, and you use that wonderful line earlier about your, what did you say about filling up your hope? There was a term used. I can't remember.
Hope is the anchor to the soul.
Yeah, yeah. And so this idea is it really gives people hope to say, well, my God, if that can happen in a human brain in front of me, someone I know, someone who's part of this team, what else is possible? The truth is anything is. But, Gary, you know, I wonder. I often wonder about this, and I've never asked this question before, maybe once, but in over 140 shows. But, you know, on this subject, is there a question I could ask you right now that would help people understand more of what you do and more range? What would be a great question for me to ask you right now, do you think? Do you have one?
Not really. You've been firing some pretty good ones away at me, you know?
All right. Well, that's fine. I didn't want to put you on the spot, but I just wanted, I wanted really about, you know, the work and the stuff you do. But because if I was to show the range of what you do, you know, from working with small teams, from working with large organizations, and then, you know, some of the stuff you do beyond first class, it really excites me. I mean, you take small groups of people, sort of like beyond first class to these wonderful experiences in their life. And I wanted people to know a couple of other things that you did, because that's pretty remarkable. Could you give us a little view into that other part of your life where you're really, you know, leading people down these wonderful experiences that really, you know, life memories, and tell me a little bit about that beyond first class thing you do.
Yeah, I'm very passionate, as you know, about aviation. So I'm all into aviation. I fly the helicopters and the jets and the airplanes and all that good stuff. So I've got a program where I bring people with me in my plane, and I fly them to the Caribbean. Usually we stay at Sandals Resorts, and I do some island hopping. There's some other islands that I've been going to for the last probably 20, 25 years that I go just to relax and get my head clear. So I take a group of people, and it's like a four-day coaching program where we limit it to usually anywhere from 6 to 12 people. And we just live an incredible life where we travel to different islands, and you come in my cockpit with me. You can come in and sit in the cockpit or right behind me. And we just have a very relaxed atmosphere where it's very, you know, it's not intrusive. It's very, you know, sandals, flip-flops, and shorts. And it gives me an opportunity to work with people who have the desire to really take their life to a whole nother level. So it's one of my passions, the Caribbean. As you know, I'm originally from there. So that's my thing, that I get people to come with me, and they come and just have a four-day experience that just literally changes their life.
And why do you think environment like that, pulling people out of an environment and taking them into places like that where they really step out of the everyday to do this kind of work, why is that important?
Because of what you just said. They don't step out of the everyday. And we're so prone to our behaviors and habits that we become what I refer to as insular. It's a very powerful word. We have insular thinking. As men, we think like men. As a woman thinks like a woman. If we as a man can think more like a woman, we'd be better men, and vice versa. So the point here is when we get so caught up into the normal routine of our work and our normal pressures, wake up, do the kids, we become insular in our thinking that is the only way it is. And we get so easily wrapped up that way. So, and we get out of that insular thinking by changing the course, by experiencing what it's like to fly in a private aircraft or a private jet and jumping onto little islands, all of a sudden, things start to look a little different. You start to have a vision of what you're capable, or, you know, what it's possible of doing. And that's why it's so important to regularly disengage when we can and do it more often, because what it does, it helps us to get ourselves out of the picture in the frame. Being the picture in the frame is that insular thinking. And when we get out of that, that's when we start seeing a huge contrast, and it gets the juices flowing, and then we can start seeing more of the possibilities of what we're capable of doing.
Wow, that's awesome. I'm going to sneeze. I can feel it. Hold on. Let's see if I can change that thought.
Well, while you're sneezing, I'll throw something else at you too. One of the things I have another program on, how to live the lifestyle of a millionaire. Too often people have great goals, which is great, but they don't taste the lifestyle that they want until they wait for years and years to get there. And between now and the time they want to have that lifestyle is usually years out. There's a lot of discouragement along the way. So my point here is I tell people, like I just had a presentation with Mercedes today. I'm in Chicago right now. And the guy said to me, you know, I'd like to fly too. I have that as a goal. I said, just take $150 and get an instructor and tell them you want to fly around and see what it's like. You don't have to spend the $10,000 to get your license yet. Just $150, get the taste of it. And when you start tasting it, that's the feeling. That's the lifestyle of a millionaire. So taste it. So you don't have to, you know, spend tens and tens of thousands of dollars to do a lot of things just to taste it. Like I tell people, you know, you want to take your life to another level and have a better lifestyle, you know, and let's say you don't pay somebody to clean your house. Pay somebody, even if it's once every 2 months, even if it's $20 or $30, and you have to scrape the $20 or $30, taste it. Taste what it's like. Because when you taste what it's like, you're going to say, wow, that tastes pretty good. I want some what? I want some more. And you're going to come up with ways to have more so you can do more. And a lot of times we don't think that way. We get so wrapped up into our insular routine and our thinking that we don't move ahead to the bigger stuff by just tasting it just a little bit.
I really love that. And it's as we sort of draw to the very end of the show here, I just want to mention a couple of things about your books. I know that you've got, you just hit number one on Amazon and people can find it. Gary Cox /persistent, Gary Cox /, and that Cox is C-O-X-E, E on the end,
yeah,
right?
Just go into Amazon and where it says search, just type in my name with the E at the end, Gary Cox, and then type persistent, Gary Cox Persistent, and you'll see that book.
And then you've got a new one coming out as well. I don't know if you, I probably...
Can't talk about that one yet.
I know, but I just...
I cheated and showed it to you. That's coming out soon. I have two more books coming out soon in the next probably... at least 6 months to a year.
Yeah, well, you got to get off your duff. You're not doing anything.
I know. I'm a pretty boring guy.
Hey, Gary, listen, I always ask this last question of every one of my guests. Kick-ass life, to have a kick-ass life. The show's called The Kick-Ass Life, as you know. Yes. What does it mean to you to have a kick-ass life?
It means to pick and choose and design the life that you want. You don't have to have it overnight, but start designing it. It doesn't happen overnight. How and where do you want to go with it? And then start doing things today to make it happen and touch and feel and taste that, you know, that lifestyle that we were talking about. So a lot of times for people to get to that level, they think they have to have all this money and time. You can taste it right now. There's little things that you can do every single week to taste that lifestyle.
I love that. I really love that. I'll be stealing that line from you, by the way. I appreciate it. Gary, as ever, I know we've chatted already this week and just caught up as buddies. And, thanks for coming on the show. And I really appreciate your wisdom. And this has been really helpful for a lot of people. So thanks.
And hey, thanks for trusting me. And it's been a pleasure. Look forward to spending some more time again together, David. Thank you so much.
Awesome.
Well, so here we are. Is that a store you're looking at?
Yeah.
Look at that.
It's Target.
I push record and Jen's like little squirrel over here. Whoa, look, a shop. Anyway, so you can hear Gary, that stuff's real. I mean, there's nothing fake about what he did. And watching that transition just gives you tremendous hope. And everything, all of my guests talk about, I mean, John Assaraf has done immense studies on the brain with some of the top brain scientists in the world. And with neuroplasticity, you know, it shows that we can completely rewire ourselves, reprogram ourselves for success, for financial success, for happiness. It doesn't matter where we're at, what we've gone through. And so many of us get stuck in our circumstances, and we focus on that. And Jen, you had that happen the other day, right, with your car. Tell us a little insight. What happened? Why don't you share a little bit what happened with your car?
Well, I think we shared this on Saturday's show, but I pulled into the driveway of our old house and parked at the bottom of the driveway instead of the top and didn't pull the handbrake on. So the car managed to roll backwards down the driveway, cross the street, and smash into the neighbor's fence.
Knocked it over. Brand new big metal fence and a concrete post. But Jen, what I'm asking you to think about right now is this whole reconditioning. Because in the beginning, you sort of fell into the old...
Yeah, my old pattern was that...
The world had ended. Chicken licking is about to die.
And how am I going to pay for this? And oh my goodness, it's the end of the world. And had my hands on my forehead and thought it was all over.
So I had to snap her out of it real fast, you know, and in the end, within about 4 minutes, she's taking goofy photographs of the car and the accident, you know, and so it's just one of those things where it is a choice, and we do have that choice. But in saying that, you know, we have to drive. I'm driving a car, recording a show, uploading to Dropbox. This is just not something we should be doing. Jen looked terrified a few minutes ago as I weaved through 6 lanes of traffic. But, you know, a couple of things. We do have one spot, I think, or maybe two, left for the Belize trip in July. If you're interested, come along. It's going to be awesome. We've got people coming from England. We've got people coming from Australia. It's going to be absolutely incredible. So we're going to have the best week of our lives there. If you feel like hanging out with me and some of my Star... And you, little Jen, and some of our Star Trainers. In fact, one of the guys that just signed up last week, Dave Gilts, he just won the Western Natural Bodybuilding Competition. You should see this guy. He is just ripped. So he's now coming down. Just some really interesting, fascinating people. And that's what it's all about when we get together with friends, is to really have that... that beautiful connection. So those of you that are interested, you can get hold of my or go to thekickasslife.com/Belize. If you want to come along, do that. Other than that, you know, we'll see you on the other side. Anything you want to add there, young lady?
See you in Belize.
All right, see you later, guys.
Thanks for listening to The Kick-Ass Life with David Wood. Stay connected on Facebook /The Kick-Ass Life, on Twitter @The Kick-Ass Life, and of course at thekickasslife.com.
That was kick-ass.